This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with Attorney Jim Lafferty about the impeachment trial that's going on in the Senate. Is democracy and the rule of law totally trashed in this country? Chris Hedges interviewed me about Michael Ratner and his new book, published posthumously, called Moving the Bar, My Life as a Radical Lawyer. We did the show on RT, Chris's On Contact show on television, and we want you to have a chance to take a listen to it.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
According to a study by the Chicago Project, published last week in the Atlantic magazine, the Capitol rioters weren't like other extremists. Most of them were middle-aged and middle-class. 40% of them were business owners or had white-collar jobs as CEOs, shop owners, doctors, even lawyers. Only 9% of them belonged to paramilitary groups like the Three Percenters or the Boogaloo Boys or the Proud Boys. Most of them did not come from deep red states, and a lot of them had money problems, rent, bankruptcy, taxes. The article stated that the overwhelming reason the rioters cited again and again in court documents was that they were following Trump's orders to keep Congress from certifying Joe Biden as the winner of the presidential election. They believed Trump's big lie that the election was stolen. When Trump spoke at the rally before they marched on the Capitol, he advised them to show strength, that, quote, we fight like hell, and if we don't fight like hell, we're not going to have a country anymore. So let's walk now to the Capitol. For this, he's been charged with inciting insurrection and is being tried by the United States Senate. If found guilty, he would not be able to run for president again in 2024. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said that the crowd was provoked by the president, and then he said the mob was fed lies. Liz Cheney, the House Republican conference chair, broke with her party and summed up the case against Trump as follows. She said, "The president of the United States summoned this mob, assembled the mob, and lit the flame of this attack. Everything that followed was his doing." None of this would have happened without the president. The president could have forcibly intervened to stop the violence. He did not. There has never been betrayal of a president of the United States of his office and his oath to the Constitution. In his defense, Republicans say that his speech was protected by the First Amendment, and secondly, they argue that since he has left office, he can't be tried. Trump's lawyers argued before the Senate on the first day of the trial that a guilty verdict against Trump will tear our country apart. Others have argued that the country is already torn apart, that there's a brewing American fascist movement going on, that this movement has contempt for democracy and the rule of law. They see it as congealing, getting stronger, and looking to Trump as its leader. We speak today with Attorney Jim Lafferty, the Executive Director Emeritus of the National Lawyers Guild in Los Angeles. He's a member of the Governing Board of the American Civil Liberties Union of Southern California, and he's an elected fellow at the Institute for the Humanities at the University of Southern California. Mr. Lafferty is a founding member and steering committee member of the National Julian Assange Defense Committee and the recent chair of the Office of the Americas. Jim Lafferty is the host of the Lawyers Guild radio show on our sister station in Los Angeles, KPFK. For the past 60 years, Mr. Lafferty has been a recognized national leader in various movements against the U.S. wars of intervention, such as in Vietnam, Central America, and the Middle East. Jim Lafferty, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Well, my friend, it's good to be back with you always, always. How are you today?
Well, I'm recovering from my second COVID shot.
All right. Well, better you get it than not.
Glad to be speaking with you. Glad to be on vertical. Jim, what was your reaction when you saw the Democrats opening video of what happened on January 6th?
The whole thing I've watched, I haven't missed many moments of the whole thing, and it's all been beyond belief, frankly. We had seen much of this before, of course, but when you see it put together as it was put together so brilliantly by the House managers, its effect is far more devastating and far more a much more powerful effect than when you saw it in drips and drabs over the day itself of January the 6th.
It's obvious from watching it that the impeachment managers made a compelling and sufficient case to convict Trump in the Senate. So why is it almost 100% certainty that Trump's not going to be found guilty by the 17 Republican senators that are needed to convict him?
Because I'm aware of that, as we all are, that's likely the case. They talk about these senators, in fact, with their feet up on the desk reading the day's newspaper or, I don't know, clipping their nails or something in many cases. In my own mind, the failure, and it will be, of course, the failure of the Senate to convict on the impeachment charge brought by the House is, I think, a more profound and more worrisome wound on the character and the history of the United States, a far greater shameful blemish, frankly, than what happened on January 6th itself. As horrible as that is, and I'm surprised to hear myself saying that, but I believe that. If the Senate of the United States, which was the focus of the attack itself on January 6th, with as clear a case of guilt as has ever been presented in any courtroom, and I've done a fair amount of trial work, refuses because of their lack of backbone, because of their worry about their own petty reelection. At this tragic moment of American history, this profound moment of America, can't rise to the occasion and do what their conscience clearly tells them they should do, which is to convict. That is, as I say, as I think even a more serious blow, and will be perhaps recognized historically as a more serious and damning indictment of what is happening in America today than was the insurrectionist attack of January 6th itself.
The Republicans defend Trump on the grounds that his speech on January 6th was protected by the First Amendment. Do you believe this? You're on the board of the Los Angeles chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, which has fought for a century for free speech and in support of the First Amendment. Is this a First Amendment case?
It's not a First Amendment case at all, and I'm an absolutist pretty much when it comes to the First Amendment. There's a legal difference, a profound legal difference between what the burden of proof is and what the reach of the First Amendment is when you're talking about an impeachment case and when you're talking about a criminal or a civil trial, for that matter, in the courts of America. They're simply two different things. All that has to be shown here is whether or not Trump bore responsibility for it. He doesn't have to be guilty of it as he might be found guilty of it in a court of law, and therefore where he could present the defense of the First Amendment, the famous Brandenburg case involving the Ku Klux Klan and so forth and so on. The First Amendment might very well, if Trump were to be tried in a criminal court in the United States, be able to assert the First Amendment defense. It is simply irrelevant to a impeachment case in the Congress of the United States.
The second defense the Republicans are putting forward is that as a matter of law, Trump cannot be tried because he's not in office anymore. They say the only reason he's being tried is to prevent the millions of people who voted for him the first time and then voted for him again and who want to vote for him again the third time in 2024 will be prevented from doing this if he's found guilty, and that this will tear the country apart. The Democrats counter that there cannot be any unity without accountability. Are both of these propositions true?
Well, the second one is probably true, but more to the point, they've also argued, of course, as you know, the first day of argument was whether or not there was any jurisdiction for the very reason that you mentioned, whether or not you can try someone, a government official, in this case, a former president. But it's for acts that he did while he was the president. If this was something that he did after he was the president, they would have had a good case. But as the House managers presented with, by quoting the historians, the constitutional lawyers from the Federalist Society, for God's sakes, from the Federalist Papers themselves, this was those who believe, as the Republicans claim to, in the originalist interpretation of the Constitution and all the rest, the case that the House managers presented, both historically and in terms of what the great majority of constitutional lawyers believe today, is that you certainly can, and there is precedent for doing so, you certainly can try a public official who commits an act which would be subject to impeachment, and the fact that otherwise you have what is called this January exception that Raskin was talking about. The president, any president could do any damn thing he or she wanted to do in the last month of office, and before anybody had time to hold them account to it, their term of office would be over and they'd be away scot-free. I mean, that's ludicrous. And of course, that's why people who have found themselves in that situation in the past have been tried, have been convicted, despite the fact that they were out of office by the time of their actual trial. But while they were in office, they committed the deed for which they are now standing trial, or more technically, standing an impeachment trial. So that was and that's something they're simply put forward because they don't want to have to say that the president is not responsible for the insurrection itself. So they're trying to hide behind the fact, part of their gutlessness again, part of their lack of integrity again. They want instead to be able to say, well, whether or not he should be responsible, or, you know, for the actions, you know, is beside the point because we have no jurisdiction to really try him. That's nonsense. They know it's nonsense. And I think based on what the American people have now seen and heard, the American people know it's nonsense, except for that clique of Trumpian folks who do not respond in a normal way to any information.
Well, what about is it a threat when they say this will tear the country apart if we convict him?
I don't see any evidence of that. I mean, the FBI and the Homeland Security and every other agency that would know about this has already said that we have not seen the end of the violence that is going to be coming down the way, and that is in keeping with the violence and for the same reasons that we saw on January 6th, not simply make sure a president gets a second term, but because you've got a number of right-wing and racists and xenophobic groups in the country, Christian nationalist groups, if you will, in the country, that are hell-bent on not letting America become what it is becoming, a diverse nation in which people of all colors and nationalities have equal opportunities, finally, hopefully, to succeed. And so that's why the FBI, the Homeland Security, are predicting that there is more violence that we can expect ahead, that January 6th was not the end of that new bubbling civil war, if you will. So the notion that you therefore would not have an impeachment trial because somehow by not having it, you would still that process, that prediction of future violence is stupid, irrespective of what the Congress does, whether they impeach, find him guilty or do not find him guilty. This civil war that we're in is going to continue to simmer, continue to boil over from time to time. To what extent, we don't know yet. But this impeachment trial is not to be blamed for whatever comes next, that's for sure. I would look at it from a different point of view. If you do not impeach the president of the United States for what he did in this case, what would a president have to do to constitute having done an impeachable offense? I mean, people died. More than 100 people were injured. I don't need to go on and on with what happened on January 6th. If you cannot impeach the instigator of that, the supporter of that, the cheerleader of that, the planner of that in many ways, what would he have to do? Would he have to personally set a bomb under the Capitol building? Would he personally have to, I don't know, have shot the vice president himself before it might be considered an impeachable offense? I mean, when I hear myself talking this way, it's enough to make you feel crazy. Obviously, he's guilty, and obviously this is an impeachable offense. And to not have done this would have set such a precedent that the notion of the president being accountable to the law in any real way would lose all meaning, and then you have essentially an autocracy, a dictatorship.
So how do you explain the breadth and the depth of support that Trump has and the passion that underscores his supporters' actions and beliefs?
Well, I made reference to that a minute ago. There's a book I would recommend in that regard to your listeners, by the way. It really has to do with the overarching effect of Christian nationalism. Andrew Whitehead and Samuel Perry wrote a book called Taking America Back for God. And they describe what Christian nationalism is. They talk about its assumptions of nativism, you know, white supremacy, patriarchy, divine sanction for authoritarian control. They write about all that. It's ethnic, really, as well as it is religious, of course. And Christian nationalism really contends that America has been and should always be distinctly Christian. But they mean a certain type of Christianity. You know, they're not talking about Jesus is on the Mount. From top to bottom, it should be. Its self-identity, its interpretations of its own history, everything it holds sacred, all its, well, you know, cherished values, everything, are basically what they think the founding fathers meant by it. And it's white and it's male dominated, and it has a certain kind of religiosity to it. It's determined, in essence, to put it in its, I guess, rawest form. It's determined that, quote, you know, Jews will not replace us, Mexican rapists will not replace us, Muslim terrorists will not replace us, quote unquote. I'm quoting others on that. That's that, and they feel they're under attack more than ever. You've got, you know, millions of people, and I'm not saying everybody who voted for Trump is falls under it. Some voted just because they want a tax break. Some voted because they want less regulations. They don't give a damn about the rest of the country and people of color and what's happening to them and immigrants and so forth. But at the heart of it, at the heart of those screaming, crazy mobs, and you saw it. They had crosses there, and they brought to the Capitol insurrection. They talked about this is white America, and they chanted again who was not going to replace them. And that's why Trump, you know, as long as he changed his position on abortion, as long as he was willing to do all sorts of other things that these millions of feeling left behind and Americans who can't deal with the changing culture, can't deal with the changing demographics of this country, you know, he could grab as many women's crotches as he wanted, as long as he would give them their kind of old-fashioned, bigoted, rigid, as I say, white supremacist Christian nationalism. That's a big part of that 74 million votes that he got, and it's a serious problem. And not unexpected. I don't think it's surprising that a country of white supremacists would feel challenged when the whole nature of the game seems to change. And then add to that, Michael, if you add to that the fact that both capitalist parties have really ignored the needs of many of these people, in fairness, too. And the gap between rich and poor, you know, all of that has gotten greater and greater over time. The sense of job security, the loss of unions, we can go on forever about it. I mean, they it's understandable why they would fall prey to the local grifter like Trump, who would come along and promise jobs that he never had intention of delivering and build walls against the people they don't want having coming into the country and make fun of the people that they hate and disparage. So it's sort of perfect storm, which has developed, and it doesn't show any signs of the sun coming out anytime soon.
Yeah, I was going to ask you whether you would define this as something like a national psychosis, you know, this national crisis that we're in.
Yeah, I don't think that's an unfair description at all. I think it is that. I mean, when you look at people who believe these bizarre theories of QAnon, I mean, my God, how can anybody who we think of as rational, I'm always very nervous, you know, people who have very different and strange ideas, I don't think should be locked up necessarily in institutions because of those ideas. But that doesn't mean that it's not dangerous to have millions of people going down the rabbit hole of craziness when it comes to public policy and what is really governing this country. I mean, to believe that one of the two parties in the country are, you know, molesting small children and drinking their blood or something, or that some spaceship is that controlled by Jews for some reason, I didn't know they were any Jewish astronauts. What do I know? That are literally, you know, or baseball players. Yeah, not many baseball. Although Hank Greenberg was one of my heroes as a young boy, so be careful. But we laugh at that, but that's very dangerous because then real facts are no longer facts, and the early efforts of the Trump administration to create alternative facts, to the extent that one can believe there are such things as alternative facts, a different plane, a different universe of reality where the facts are different, leaves you ripe for QAnon and for that kind of mass psychosis that you're talking about. We've seen it in smaller ways in the past when some believer in God and the afterlife and the end of the world predicts the world's going to end on June 3rd, and so everybody gives up their belongings. Well, I mean, everybody, you know, 500 people do, and then June 3rd comes along, and by God, the world's still here, and so you lose a few of those people, and that particular grifter just says, I didn't mean June 3rd, I meant December 3rd, and, you know, gets their money again. It's hypnotic, it's seductive, and because of this disorientation of the country, as I say, and because of the desperation, people try to go into any port in a storm. And if you find yourself bewildered and can't figure out this changing world that you're living in that doesn't look and feel, and the people don't look and sound the same, their foods don't taste the same, the smell of their spices is not the same, the look of their skin is not the same, you, next thing you know, you find yourself looking for any port in the storm, and QAnon and grifters like Trump and crazy theories about what the world was really supposed to be like and who's making it otherwise become all too believable to all many people. And I guess it's maybe not even fair to call it a psychosis if 74 million people believe it. It's a belief system. And I suppose if Bill Maher was with us, he'd say it's no crazier than all religious beliefs, no crazier than Scientology, no crazier than the Catholic Church's beliefs. I'm sounding like Bill Maher now, and I don't mean to, but you get my point.
I do. Our friend Michael Ratner used to say that democracy and the rule of law were in the process of being trashed, and that in the end, democracy and the rule of law were not compatible with capitalism. He said that fascism was, but not democracy and the rule of law.
And the proof is in the fact that we don't have a real democracy in this country anyway. When you look at the role that money plays, which has to do with capitalism, when you look at the power that the capitalists have, the corporations have, over who really gets elected, who can afford to get elected, who can afford to run the campaigns, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, the media, the role the media plays and who gets elected, you put it all together, and it's a democracy on paper to a certain extent, certainly. But anybody who really thinks that it's easy to prove that, by the way, you can ask the American people on a whole whether they think the rich should pay more taxes, and 75% of them will say yes. You could ask them, do you think welfare benefits should be increased, the minimum wage? You get substantial majorities, but that's not the way they vote in Congress, because the people who got elected to Congress got elected by people who don't have that point of view, i.e., corporate America. And that's why it is a corporate autocracy, really, in this country today, and not a democracy.
Well, that's been proven. There were two professors from Northwestern and Princeton who did a study, a very detailed study, about whether what your average American thought and wanted, and it was that translated into the legislature and the laws that were passed. And their effect on the legislature was absolutely zero.
Oh, boy, yeah, I know. We think so. I often say when somebody asks me when I got sour on capitalism, when I got sour on the notion this was true democracy, the only time any people ever get what they want in this country, really, if it's on a big enough issue, if it's a war that they don't want to fight, if it's child labor laws they want to have passed, if it's the right of a woman to have control of her own body for reproductive purposes, the country only responds finally after masses of people have taken to the streets and protested and gone to jail and refused really to let there be peace and quietness in the country until the will of the people is realized. But it's not realized simply through the election of our legislators. They do not represent, by and large, certainly on the most significant issues, what the majority of the people of this country want. It is not a democracy in that sense at all. Don't confuse the American governance with what goes on at town halls in Vermont.
We've been talking with Attorney Jim Lafferty. Jim, we're coming down to the end of our allotted time, but before I let you go, I just wanted to point out, and I'm sure you agree with me, that all is not gloom and doom. Think back at the magnificent uprising last June of some 20 million people, black and white, led by young black people. What will it take to defeat Trump and Trumpism? And what is it going to take to move forward in a progressive way? Talk about any port in a storm, and don't we need to put up our own port?
Yeah, right, and that flows quite naturally. Good question, Mike, because that flows quite naturally from what I think we've both been saying. Exactly. I mean, there has been, we've seen it right over here in our own county in Los Angeles. We have a new district attorney who has already agreed with a number of demands of the Black Lives Matter movement that you were referring to last summer. And that's happening all over the country. We still got a long way to go on that. But it's only happening, as I said before, because, in this case, millions and millions of people over a period of, and they're still doing it, are in the streets demanding nothing less but having, but changing policing practices, changing prosecutorial practices, changing practices around imprisonment and what have you. That's a model of the kind of program we need. We need it not just in the area of police reform. We need it in the area of economic reform. I mean, you know, we need in the area of healthcare reform and all the other things that a capitalist society has screwed up for so many people in this country. And in the same way that people united with the Black Lives Matter movement to realize the victories they've realized so far, and there are more, I believe, that lie ahead, so too the broader left movements in this country, progressive movements, liberal movements, socialist movements, have to find a measure of unity and action which allows them to take on these issues too, and in the same sustained and powerful and courageous way that Black Lives Matter did, stay in the streets and stay organized until we've made the kind of revolutionary changes really in this country. And it won't be easy. It's going to be a long, long struggle. And on the other side of it, where you're going to still have people who did what they did at the Capitol. It's a dangerous period that's ahead, but we can either let those people have the run of the place, or we can do what I'm suggesting, and I know you believe, Mike, which is get the good and decent and honest people in this country together who now recognize that that capitalism is not working for the majority of the people, and organize in the streets, not simply on Election Day, to bring about the kind of movement that is needed to do what you're suggesting, Mike.
Jim Lafferty, how can people follow your work?
Well, the Lawyers Guild show, you know, is our sister show on radio here in Los Angeles. We're on KPFK. It's 90.7 FM. It streams worldwide on the web at kpfk.org. We're on every Wednesday from 2 to 3 o'clock. It's a show much like your show, Mike, with you and Heidi. And I do get listeners from all over the country listening to it when we're on the air, and I invite your listeners to join us next Wednesday. We'll be doing some interesting things as usual, and that's 90.7 FM, 2 to 3 Pacific Standard Time, of course, the Lawyers Guild Show.
Jim Lafferty, great to have you on Law & Disorder. Thank you so much. We'll check back in with you, try to catch up on what's going to happen with this impeachment trial. You take it easy.
Oh, my goodness, yeah. And one last thing, if I can just quickly say, what they could have done, what they can still do, is go to the 14th Amendment. We didn't get a chance to talk about Section 3, and with the simple majority of the Congress, which I think they could get, prohibit Trump from ever holding public office again.
Okay, Jim, you take it easy.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Two weeks ago, Chris Hedges interviewed me about Michael Ratner and his new book, Moving the Bar, My Life as a Radical Lawyer. We want to play that interview for you now.
Welcome to On Contact. Today we discuss the legacy of the radical civil rights attorney Michael Ratner with his close collaborator and friend Michael Smith.
Michael took what seemed to be a hopeless case and he lost. He went up to the Court of Appeals and he lost. He went up to the Supreme Court and they won. And he, along with a team of 600 lawyers that he had organized to defend the Bill of Rights, went on to litigate those cases, and they eventually freed. They forced Bush to free over 500 of these prisoners, and they stopped Bush from torturing these men. So I think that amongst the many, many great cases that Michael handled or initiated, that was probably the foremost case.
Michael Ratner was one of the most important civil rights attorneys of our era. He spent his life fighting on behalf of those the state and the empire sought to crush. From the leaders of the prison uprising at Attica to Muslim prisoners held in Guantanamo to Julian Assange. First in his class at Columbia Law School, he could have easily slipped into the lucrative world of corporate law. But Michael wanted something more than money and status out of life. He wanted to make a difference. He wanted to make the world a better place. Michael, who died in 2016, was the president of the National Lawyers Guild. He spent 40 years at the Center for Constitutional Rights, first as a staff attorney, then litigation director, and finally as president. He helped establish the European Center for Human and Constitutional Rights and the Palestine Legal Fund to defend supporters of the Palestinian people against what he called the Palestine exception to the First Amendment. In 2004, he started the radio show Law and Disorder on WBAI with other attorneys, including Michael Smith, and it is now broadcast nationally on 120 stations. As a lawyer, often working pro bono, he won historic legal victories, such as protecting Haitians infected with the HIV virus who were initially confined by the U.S. at its military base in Guantanamo, Cuba. He initiated and organized some 600 lawyers in firms large and small across the country to come to the defense of Muslim prisoners accused of terrorism and held at Guantanamo after 9/11. He took the case to the Supreme Court and won for these prisoners the basic right of habeas corpus. He was, as Vladimir Lenin wrote, as radical as reality itself. He understood that those who are above the struggle are also beside the point. He had four key principles of being a radical lawyer. Do not refuse to take a case just because it has long odds of winning in court. Use cases to publicize a radical critique of U.S. policy and to promote revolutionary transformation. Combine legal work with political advocacy. And finally, love people. Joining me to discuss Michael Ratner's recently published memoir, Moving the Bar, My Life as a Radical Lawyer, is his close friend and collaborator for nearly three decades, the attorney Michael Smith. So I want you, Michael, as an attorney who has been long in this struggle, to set the stage for us, because I think reading Michael's book, you get a sense that it's almost a rear guard action, that there was a period, certainly right after the 1960s, the late 60s, early 70s, when the courts were a positive force for social change. But then there was this steady deterioration. I think in his book, Michael talks about the Patriot Act. He actually calls it a coup d'etat. But talk about that trajectory that really dominates your work as an attorney and Michael Ratner's work as an attorney.
Well, I think that Michael viewed the degradation and decline of democracy as something that's gone on since Ronald Reagan, really, over the last 40 years. Michael thought that democracy was not compatible, ultimately, with capitalism. He thought fascism was, but not democracy. And in the course of his almost 50 years of litigating, he saw that that decline and resisted it. Resisted it 40 years ago with his litigation around Central America. When the Nicaraguans rose up and overthrew Somoza, the dictator. Somoza was a second generation dictator. His father had been the dictator in the 30s. Roosevelt called Somoza a bastard, but he's our bastard. His kid came to power. Was overthrown by the Nicaraguans, who tried to control their own country and their own lives. And an organization called the Contras was established to overthrow the Nicaraguan Revolution. Reagan called them the George Washington of his times. And Michael began litigating what was an illegal war in financing the Contras. That was 40 years ago. And so I think that you make the point that it's been a rearguard action, actually, since then. Michael didn't live to see the consequences of Trump, but Trump is really a reflection of that, isn't he?
Yes. I was in Central America then. It's so funny how many times Michael's lives, work and life converged with my own. Of course, later I was in the Middle East, and then I flew to London with Michael to meet Julian Assange. Michael was going almost every month to London as Assange's lead attorney in the United States. Let's talk about the deterioration of law, which Michael talks about in his book. Let's kind of lay out for people what has happened to diminish our democracy and diminish our rights as citizens over the last few decades. I know not just going even before the Authorization to Use Military Force Act in 2002, I believe that was that the right year. But going back even to the misuse of grand juries, talk about how the judiciary, and I think one of the points Michael makes in the book, that it's really the legal system that makes significant change. It's never the elected politicians who are too cautious. So it was the judiciary was kind of the last readout. And talk about that process, you know, the legal decisions that have diminished the judiciary as an effective force for our own rights and our own protection.
Well, Michael saw law as a method of social control created by a socioeconomic system that was determined at all costs to perpetuate itself by any means necessary and for as long as possible. So he understood the rule of law. Now, there are exceptions. The Bill of Rights is an exception. The American Constitution did not contain the Bill of Rights initially, and it was only the small shopkeepers and farmers, the people who actually made the revolution, that would not support the Constitution until they put in a Bill of Rights. So there's a contradiction between capitalist law and the Bill of Rights, and it was in that area, that contradiction, that Michael worked. He started off, well, let me just begin with some background for Michael, because I think it's important for our viewers to understand that Michael came from an immigrant family in Cleveland. His father came from Poland, Bialystok, Poland, at age 20. He was 5'4" tall. He didn't speak English. He spoke Yiddish. He married a woman from an extremely poor family, Ann Spott. She was the 11th of 12 children who grew up during the Depression in Cleveland. And that's how they started out. When Michael was born, Yiddish was his first language. His parents had to send him to school to learn how to articulate English. The parents were attached really to the old country, and many of their relatives were killed during the Holocaust. So Michael remembers as a young child, men at his father developed into a successful businessman. He started off literally carrying water on a construction site, and he became the head of a company that sold building supplies. And he hired black people, and he hired refugees from the deportation camps, Jews with numbers on their forearms. His mother took Michael and his younger brother, Bruce, around looking for apartments so they could help resettle these refugees from Poland. So Michael saw that terrible consequence of the Second World War, and he grew up with that consciousness. And the thing I think that turned him into what he became was his experiences in 1968. And I think it's important to understand for our listeners who are younger than we are that 1968 was a crucial year in world history in many respects. The Vietnamese Revolution was unfolding. The United States was trying to stop it unsuccessfully. The Civil Rights Movement was unfolding. There were huge uprisings in 67. King was killed then. The French workers and students almost made a revolution. De Gaulle, who was the head of France, left the country. If it wasn't for the reformism and hesitancy of the Communist Party, we would have had a socialist France. The undemocratic Stalinist dictatorship in Czechoslovakia was almost overthrown. So the world was in an upheaval. Michael took a year off of Columbia Law School and went down to Baltimore to work for the NAACP and the Civil Rights Movement. And he came back to Columbia Law School on the very day that the students had occupied several buildings on the campus. And Michael showed up, the cops raided these buildings, brutalized the students. 700 students were sent to the hospital. Michael was grabbed and beaten down to the ground and badly hurt. And I think that's what changed Michael. That was the crucial point, because he understood the role that Columbia was playing. They had tried to build a gym on a park in Harlem, and they put up a separate door in the back for black people. They had an institution that helped theoretical studies on the war in Vietnam and do mathematics. They were connected to the whole imperial system. And Michael thought about what his uncle had told him, don't work for somebody else. But Michael decided he would work for somebody else, but that somebody else wouldn't be a private corporation in a white shoe law firm, that somebody else would be the movement. And when he graduated 2 years later, he went and got a job with Constance Bakely Marker, who was the only black federal judge in the country. When he got out of that job, he started a private law practice with Margaret Ratner, who became his wife. And then in 1971, he was asked to work at the Center for Constitutional Rights. The center had come out of the civil rights movement. The three leaders of the center were the great lawyers at that time for the civil rights movement. Bill Kunstler, of course, our listeners will remember, but also Morton Stavis and Arthur Conoy. And they had a little loft in the pornography district on 42nd Street, little walk up in one room. There were about 12 people in the room. And instead of joining a law firm that was real fancy with suites, Michael joined this one room loft in the porno district on 42nd Street. 3 days later, they sent them to Attica. It was the first day that outsiders were allowed to come in to Attica. And Michael's job was to interview the prisoners on what happened. It was a massacre. Governor Rockefeller had his eyes on becoming president. He didn't want to see his opponents talking about him as being soft on the rebellion. The prisoners had rose up for good reason in this overcrowded medieval fortress just south of Buffalo. And they had taken over the prison. And Rockefeller called in the troops and they gunned down people in the D yard. They killed 37 people. And Michael went up there to find out what happened. That was his first assignment from the center. He was a staff attorney there. He became the litigation director. Then he became the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. He stayed there for 40 years. And that's something that we could talk about, the various cases that he handled when he was part of the center.
Great. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation about Michael Ratner's new memoir with the attorney Michael Smith. Welcome back to On Contact. We continue our conversation about Michael Ratner's new memoir, Raising the Bar, with the attorney Michael Smith. I want to go back, Michael, to his work with Judge Motley. He writes in the book, but the appeals court very often reversed Judge Motley's decisions, and her courthouse critics gossiped that Judge Motley was, quote unquote, not that smart, referring to a woman who had argued 10 cases in the Supreme Court and won 9 of them. No appeals court judge had a record close to that. Not that smart, Ratner writes, simply meant that the conservative, business-oriented appeals court did not agree with decisions she had based, at least in part, on elementary fairness or equal treatment before the law. I have often thought about this question of who is quote-unquote smart. Somehow, conventional legal pundits consider Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts quote-unquote very smart. He can upend court precedent by narrowly reading earlier decisions that established fundamental protections. He can find all the ambiguities in those cases and can color key facts in his own way. He can reach a decision that appears logical but is simply a scholastic exercise masquerading as a judicial opinion. However, when a woman and/or a black judge reads cases to establish rights broadly and interject fairness into a decision, the legal pundits label that judge not smart. And I think what he's really saying here is how those who take a broader sense of the law, as he did and as you do, a broader understanding of the law, are dismissed by the conservative hierarchy. Can you just talk about, I thought that was a really interesting point.
Yeah, very interesting. I'd like to put that in the context of what you said initially about the decline of democracy and the rule of law, because I think that Constance Baker Motley was somebody that would have upheld the rule of law and democracy, and conservatives like Roberts are the ones that are picking away at it. And I wanted to talk a bit about Michael's most famous case, Razul versus Bush, which illustrates that. Because Michael was very sensitive to the decline of democracy. And when he saw the planes hit the Twin Towers, he was down there, he was jogging past those Twin Towers when the planes hit. He knew that the world was going to be a qualitatively different place. Then the war was ginned up against Afghanistan, and then of course against Iraq on a false pretense that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and was an ally of Osama bin Laden. And then the military order number one, the authorization for the use of force, were both passed along with the Patriot Act. And that's what spurred Michael into action. The military order number one set up Guantanamo. Guantanamo was an offshore prison island. The government had schemed to set up a place where prisoners had no rights. They weren't prisoners of war, they were detainees. They weren't criminals, they were detainees. And as such, they had no rights as prisoners of war or of criminals. And Michael brought a lawsuit. He was totally alone. He had to convince the CCR to go along with it. Michael brought a lawsuit to aim to get those Muslim prisoners in this offshore prison camp on Guantanamo to get them the right of habeas corpus, which means literally produce the body. Under our law, if you're arrested, they have to tell you why they arrested you and they have to bring you in front of a judge. And they weren't doing that with these prisoners. So Michael took what seemed to be a hopeless case and he lost. He went up to the Court of Appeals and he lost. He went up to the Supreme Court and they won. And he, along with a team of 600 lawyers that he had organized to defend the Bill of Rights, went on to litigate those cases, and they eventually freed, they forced Bush to free over 500 of these prisoners, and they stopped Bush from torturing these men. So I think that amongst the many, many great cases that Michael handled or initiated, that was probably the foremost case. But we can talk about some other ones if you'd like.
I just want to pull from another section of the book, the Authorization to Use Military Force Act. Michael writes, gave the president such unprecedented, disturbing, and broad power that I was not just concerned but truly stunned. It essentially said the president can use military force to attack any country, organization, or person who aided, assisted, or harbored persons in the September 11th attacks, and that he could use that military force to prevent any further attacks. He could start wars against all 37 countries where the U.S. government claims the Al-Qaeda network is present, or against anyone else he suspects of involvement in the attacks of 9/11, or any future attacks. The president could do all this without getting any further approval from Congress, even if he leads us into World War III. So legally and politically, with the Authorization to Use Military Force Act, Congress gave up its authority over war and handed it to one individual in the White House. There was no time limit. They even gave the president a fat $20 billion check to help him along in this endless war. This is not what the framers of our Constitution imagined. On the contrary, the Constitution was drafted to keep presidential wars in check. As I read the details of the Authorization to Use Military Force Act, I could just see the excesses coming, illegal surveillance, indefinite detentions, torture, all in the name of national security. He was, one of the things about Michael is that his antenna was so acute that he instantly saw which way the winds were blowing. And of course, the famous case is Julian Assange, that he realized after the release of the Iraqi war logs, long before Julian or anyone around him did, that the U.S. state was coming for him.
Absolutely. We used to record our radio show in Michael's basement, and he had an encrypted phone at his desk. And very often, Julian Assange would call on that encrypted phone. Michael and Julian would talk almost daily. And he'd go over to London about every month because he knew that if they were able to get Julian Assange for essentially telling the truth, Julian Assange never published anything that was inaccurate. He acted as a journalist and as a publisher. He received information. He encouraged people to give him information. He took that information. He distributed that information. That's what journalists and publishers do. The Times took it, El País took it, the German papers, the French papers. And the American imperial system was so embarrassed by what Julian Assange was revealing that they decided to get him. I'm not being conspiratorial here. We have a document from the State Department that says just that. They influenced the Swedes to make a false allegation that he was guilty of rape. They destroyed his character. He fled back to London. Michael had advised him, don't go to Sweden to answer these false charges because the Swedes will send you over to the United States and they'll lock you up forever. So Michael was successful and Julian went back to England, but then went after him there too. And he finally had to take asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy. He was living in this tiny little embassy in two rooms for 7 years. So they had succeeded really in silencing him. And then the whole thing is just unbelievably illegal. They got the Ecuadorian, there was a new government in Ecuador. The first government under Rafael Correa had granted Michael asylum and citizenship in Ecuador. And that's where he was holed up now, but at least he wasn't in prison. But the American government bribed the new successor, Lenin Moreno, with several billions of dollars. And they got Moreno to agree to allow the British police to enter the embassy and snatch Julian and put him in Belmarsh prison in isolation. And so they were able to silence him and silence, cut off the funding for WikiLeaks, Julian's organization. It's an imperial worldwide system and they cannot stand any kind of objective criticism. Because it's the truth upon which democracy is based. And that's that fundamental contradiction between imperialism and democracy. So I think that Julian, who was Michael's last client, the Julian Assange case is really another high point in Michael's ability to sense the future in the instant and rally people to expose the system. And in the case of Julian to eventually free him, because I think he'll be walking amongst us very soon. The problem, though, is that the decision that Michael was fighting against Julian, they had 17 counts all violating the First Amendment against Julian for being a journalist, and the judge, Beratzer in London, upheld all those charges. So we still have a pistol pointed at our head as journalists. And Michael was in that fight to the very end.
I want to talk about this quote that you used in the foreword of Michael's book, Moving the Bar, I think it's from Lenin, about being as radical as reality itself. Explain what that means and why it was important as a kind of grounding for Michael.
Well, I think that all of us had to go through a process of learning actually what reality is, because there's an ideological system in this country. Marx said that the ideology of the ruling class is the ruling ideology. And we have an ideological system in the educational system, the communication system, and so on, that prevents us from really understanding in a radical way the roots of what's going on here. And Michael eventually, as we talked about, by 1968 came to understand that reality. And he reacted in a way that reflected that understanding. So he became as radical as reality itself.
And by that, he meant that he understood what was taking place behind the veil, the crimes of empire. He was very involved against the endemic racism within the United States, that when you looked at the actual machinery of power, the human suffering that it caused both at home and abroad was so radical that it demanded a radical response.
Yeah, precisely. Michael was not enamored of either one of the major political parties. He believed that social change came from below. He very much admired Howard Zinn, whose histories describe that. And his whole strategy in the cases that he took was to facilitate that social change from below. He would take cases that he knew he wouldn't win, but it could expose in a radical way the system that was oppressing people. On the Guantanamo cases, David Cole, who's now the director of the litigation for the American Civil Liberties Union, David asked him, why'd you take this case? And Michael said, 100% on principle. And David asked him, did you think you'd win? And he said, no, we didn't think we'd win. It was 100% on principle. And that defines Michael's radicalism, principled litigation.
And just to close, he always argued that activism was vital to judicial progress. Why?
Well, unless the system is shaken up, unless there are people in motion demanding democratic change, economic change, demanding more freedom, it's not going to happen. They're not going to give it to us. It's what Frederick Douglass said, of course, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, it never will. And Michael was using his skills as a lawyer to agitate and organize and facilitate those demands percolating up from below that would eventually change the law. We've seen it happen before. We may see it happen again, but it's going to come from below.
Great.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
By giving you no time, instead of it all, but we cannot function, we can feel nothing at all. Heard us at